Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up over the next half hour, as international Olympic teams return home with their well-deserved medals, we take a close look at the London 2012 Games and at how faith played a part. And looking ahead to the Feast of the Assumption, did Our Lady fall into an eternal slumber? Does it make any difference? We put the question to one leading Catholic scholar. But first, the latest legal developments in the case of the Pope's butler, accused of stealing private papers from the Vatican and the Pope himself. Paolo Gabriele has been formally charged with aggravated theft and will stand trial for his role in leaking private documents belonging to the Holy Father and other Curia officials to the Italian press. Emma McCarthy reports.
Paolo Gabriele has been formally charged with aggravated theft and will stand trial for his role in leaking private documents pertaining to the Holy Father and other Curia officials to Italian press. A 35-page document outlining the Vatican magistrate's charges against the former papal assistant was presented to journalists Monday by Father Federico Lombardi, Holy See Press Office Director. In the document, examining judge Piero Bonet also names a second suspect in what has familiarly become known as the VatiLeak scandal. He is Claudio Sciarpelletti, and he will stand trial on minor charges of aiding and abetting Gabriele after the fact. 48-year-old Gabriele was arrested May 23rd last after confidential letters were found in his apartment in Vatican City State. Originally held in detention in the Vatican jail, he has since been released under house arrest. Sciarpelletti is a lay computer technician at the Secretary of State and an acquaintance of Gabriele's. He was briefly detained on May 28th after police found him in possession of an envelope from the papal butler. Held overnight for questioning, Sciarpelletti was released the following morning. However, his contrasting versions of the facts during an interrogation led examining magistrates to proceed to minor charges. He has incurred a cautionary suspension from work but continues to receive his salary. According to Bonet's report, Gabriele, after having originally denied all involvement in the scandal to Pope Benedict's personal secretary, Monsignor Georg Genswein, during later interrogations confessed to having provided the documents to Italian journalist Gianluigi Nuzzi, but without receiving any money in return. While recognizing the illegal nature of his actions, Gabriele claimed they were motivated by the fact he believed the Pope uninformed of the, quote, evil and corruption which he saw in the Church. He also believed that a media shock might be healthy for the Church to bring it, quote, back onto the right track. Bonet's report also reveals that other important objects were found during a police search of the former papal assistant's house. These include a check to the sum of €100,000 made out to Pope Benedict, a gold nugget from Peru, again addressed to Pope Benedict, and a 16th century Venetian edition of the Aeneid, also destined for the Holy Father. The report states that Gabriele underwent two independent psychiatric evaluations, which, however, resulted in diverging opinions on his mental faculty at the time of his actions. The conclusions of the promoter of justice were also based on these evaluations, for whom Gabriele was well aware of the gravity and illegality of what he did. Presenting the detailed and complete findings of the Vatican magistrates to journalists, Father Lombardi underlined the desire for transparency and Pope Benedict's respect for the Vatican's magistrates' role, competence and autonomy. This, added Lombardi, also explains the fact that the outcome of the Cardinal's Commission of Inquiry into the leaks appointed by Pope Benedict early March has not yet been published, in order not to interfere with the magistrates' work. Father Lombardi also confirmed that Pope Benedict had received the report and that as Pope can intervene at any stage of the judicial process. Father Lombardi concluded that a date for the trial has not yet been set, but it will not be before September 20th when the Supreme Tribunal of the Holy See returns from summer recess. I'm Emer McCarthy.
You're listening to Vatican Radio.
Well, Well, the weekend closed with a grand finale like no other for the City of London's 2012 Olympic Games, with a huge firework display lighting up the Olympic Park and city skyline. And while countries across the globe are celebrating as their teammates bring home their well-earned medals, we wonder how faith played on the Olympic field these last weeks. When Ethiopian long-distance runner Meseret Defar crossed the finish line for Olympic gold, the very first thing she did was reach for an image of the Virgin and Child, which she had carried with her every step of her 5,000-meter race. When Irish female boxer 26-year-old Katie Taylor was announced the first-ever Olympic gold medalist in her category, her first words of thanks were for God and Jesus. Defar, an Orthodox Christian, and Taylor, a Pentecostal Christian, are just two examples of what has become an unspoken phenomenon in these Olympic Games, the quiet, understated public display of faith by the athletes of the world at London 2012. From simple crucifixes to prostrations in prayer, athletes from various religious backgrounds have brought their private, personal relationship with God into the global arena, in moving moments of thanks and praise. Bishop Richard Moth, Bishop of the British Armed Forces, was one of the spectators at the Olympics. He says this show of faith is a powerful statement in itself.
Again, there's a sign, I think, perhaps for many of us in society, that little public shows of faith are no harm. They're signs to people. Not just a personal thing, but in a very understated and simple way, there are opportunities for us to proclaim the gospel, to proclaim faith, and all those things can only be good.
Emer McCarthy spoke to Bishop Moth about the past 2 weeks in London, a very different city to the one immortalized on our TV screens some 12 months ago during violent urban riots.
The spirit is wonderful. Everybody's very jolly and happy, and there's a real sense of joy about everything that's taking place here over the summer. So it's, I think, a very positive experience. I was going through Stratford Tube Station the other day, which is close to the main Olympic Park, packed with people, but everybody in very good humour, meetings of different nations, travelling together on the transport systems, everybody looking forward to a great day's sport, and I sense a real rejoicing in the results, even if the team you're there to support doesn't win. Everybody's just delighted to be part of the experience. So it's I think it's very positive for London. We've had a wonderful year here in London this year with the Queen's Diamond Jubilee and now the Olympics. It's a very special year for us.
In all of this, of course, the bishops and the Catholic Church in England and Wales have not been sitting by idle. They've decided very much to become part of this community enterprise. And one of the most important events that you've organised around the Olympic Games has been a youth camp called the Joshua Camp, which has brought together young Catholics from over 21 nations, I believe. This camp is actually under the shadow of the Olympic Stadium in the Catholic school grounds. And you went there to meet the participants in this camp and to speak to them. Can you talk us a little bit through what the camp was, who you met, and what you had to say to them?
Yes, it's drawing together young people from the local area, a number of volunteers from all over the world, a multinational group of volunteers together working with the young people. And I was actually there able to present medals to some of the youngsters following a day of sporting activities for them, which was rather good. And a lot of very happy young people enjoying time together. And aside from just having fun, the workers who are working with them are spending time looking at catechetical issues. Some of those questions that young people often ask about, you know, why do I have to go to Mass? And all those sort of perennial questions that pop up. And it's giving the young people a great opportunity to discuss that with other youngsters, not that much older than themselves. And there are religious involved and great guidance there. And the other thing that's been fantastic about the parishes around the Olympic site and also some initiatives in the centre of London have been the opportunities offered to people for prayer. So there's been 24-hour adoration of the Blessed Sacrament in local parishes. People have gathered together for celebrations of Mass, and I was privileged to preach at a Mass in Stratford to a full church there. And that support of prayer around the Olympics, I think, is very significant. We must also add to that a very effective chaplaincy operation within the Olympic site. Great number of Catholic priests and religious involved in chaplaincy and serving the community there, together with brothers and sisters from other Christian denominations, and indeed the interfaith element that's necessary when you've got such an international gathering as this. So I think all in all, a good job is being done by the church this year in support of the Olympics. And taking that out to just the local parishioners and the local young people who may not be going to the games, but giving them a sense that they're supporting what is going on through their presence and their prayer, I think is a very powerful, powerful sign for us.
This may seem like a somewhat provocative question, but quite often Christianity, and perhaps in particular Catholicism, is seen to have a very negative view of the body. Given that general, perhaps, misconception, why is it important also for the Catholic Church to show that sport is also an integral part of how we take care of our bodies, and through taking care of our bodies, praise God?
Well, interesting you mention that. I think Pope John Paul and his wonderful reflections on theology of the body has a lot to say to us on this, and Blessed John Paul II. And, you know, we see, I think, in what's going on in the Olympic Games, the great endeavor and training that's gone on, and the excellence that you see in the Olympic Games. And at its best, that calls us to, I think, a higher reflection. We say, well, we see something of the wonder of God's creation here in what these great sportsmen and women are achieving. And so I do believe that, looked at from a faith perspective, the experience of the Olympic Games can open us up to something much wider, much greater, and can call us to really reflect on God's gifts to us, and the gift of the human person from the moment of conception to natural death. I think the Olympics and what we see there in terms of what the human frame can achieve, if you like, can invite us to those bigger questions. And I think the Catholic Church has something very special to offer there through this theology of the body of Blessed John Paul II, and the way that we're continuing to explore that and mine its richness more deeply as the years go on.
It's a very different London to the London we saw only 12 months ago, that was racked by horrific and violent riots. Do you see this as almost a cathartical event for the ordinary people, the residents of London themselves?
Well, I pray so. I do hope that's going to be the case. As I said earlier, we've had a fantastic year in London this year because people came together in massive numbers, more nationally, for the Queen's Diamond Jubilee. And in a sense, that great sort of spirit of celebration continues internationally with the Olympic Games. One must pray that one of the legacies of the Olympics won't just be the regeneration of parts of East London in particular, and the great development that's taken place there, but that it's going to reach out wider to the wider community generally. One would hope that's going to be one of the results of the Games. You know, I think our prayer must be that a big part of the legacy isn't just bricks and mortar and regenerated land. Wonderful though that be, new sporting facilities, it's all fantastic, but that it does that the spirit of the Olympics, that spirit of togetherness and that we're seeing at the moment can continue on in the months and years ahead. One would hope that that will be part of the legacy of the Olympic Games.
In this era of social media, as I was looking through the various Facebook postings and Twitters or tweets on the Olympic Games, one really struck me most forcibly, and it was a tweet by a young man who said, "We have enough of the," and then he named various, you know, celebrities from the celebrity culture in Britain. He said, "Give us more of these fine men and women athletes for our young people to aspire to."
Yes, I think that's a wonderful comment to make. And of course, there are a number of sporting heroes, if you like, who do give a fantastic example, also give of their time to young people, and some of those in sports that perhaps are a little easier for people to do. I mean, there is a little bit of me that wonders whether everybody's going to be rushing out and buying bicycles next week after our outstanding success on the cycle track. But I think beyond that, yes, there is this great sportsmanship, and it's wonderful to see people who win gold medals encouraging and supporting and sort of greeting those who perhaps not done so well. There is this sense of the taking part that's important. And there are great role models for people and role models that take us beyond just material things to something far greater. Again, going back to Blessed John Paul's theology there, a lot of these great sportsmen and women do call us to something far greater than the material, rather to perseverance, to endeavor, to that struggle that they go through in their training, I think is a lesson to many of us in all sorts of different walks of life. And it's to be hoped that our young people will take something from that. I myself was at an event last December at a school nearby where one of the old girls from the school is in the British Olympic hockey team. And she came back for the school prize giving to speak to the young women of her school. And that was hugely inspiring for them. It was a real buzz. And so I think the more of those kinds of opportunities that we can engage in into the future, it will start to make a difference from praise on a lot of our young people, yeah.
Other unsung heroes around the Olympics, of course, are the army, literally, of volunteers who are ensuring the smooth running of these games.
Huge numbers of people from all around England have volunteered just to give of their time to guide people from stations to Olympic sites, to make sure everybody's happy, just to be a welcoming face as people from all these different nations come to the games. And that's, I think, has been something that's helped the nation, if you like, to be a part of the Olympic experience. They very much represent just the ordinary man and woman on the street, to be part of the games in that way. So it's really something which is all-encompassing for our society, and one must hope that continues on into the future in the spirit of the Olympics. And I think perhaps particularly too that reflection, inviting us to go further, really, to reflect on God's gifts to us and what we see in the Olympics, will be a great legacy for the future.
And a warm thanks there to Bishop Richard Moth, Bishop of the British Armed Forces. Each year, the Catholic Church remembers the Assumption of Our Lady into Heaven on August 15th. Different traditions hold that the Virgin Mary left this earthly life between 3 and 15 years after Christ's death and resurrection. She was assumed into heaven, accounts say, as she reposed in eternal sleep, either in Jerusalem or in Ephesus in modern-day Turkey. While early accounts from the Holy Land reported that a Christian cult venerating Christ's mother had grown up around a place on Jerusalem's Mount Zion, just south of the old city walls. The spot, known from early times as Hagia Maria, continues to this day to be the site of prayers to Our Lady. Today, German-speaking Benedictine monks care for the Catholic Church of the Door Mission, built there over the ruins of a series of early Christian shrines. Today, the monks serve the church, its guests, and pilgrims, and work for peace and reconciliation in the Holy Land. Well, I sat down with the noted scholar and author Father Peter Stravinskas, who has led us on reflections on the holy sites in the land of Christ's birth, to ask him his thoughts on this Jerusalem shrine, celebrating the Virgin's death and assumption into heaven.
Yes and no. The church is in the care of German Benedictine monks. It's a beautiful, beautiful church. For people who watch EWTN and have seen Father Mitch Pacwa's rosary from the Holy Land, he does the mystery of the Assumption from the Church of the Dormition. The Dormition is the Eastern word for what we celebrate on August 15th. In the West, we refer to it as the Assumption. They refer to it as the Dormition, which means Mary's going to sleep. And when you said it's the church that commemorates Mary's death and Assumption, I said yes and no, because there's a divided opinion among theologians and a division of the theology which the church accepts. Some people say that Mary never died. And
that
so
she merely went to sleep.
Went to sleep. Mm-hmm. Hence the word Dormition. And it's fascinating if you read Pius XII's promulgation of the dogma of the Assumption. He allows for both theological opinions to coexist in the church. He says, when the course of her earthly life was finished, the Blessed Virgin Mary was assumed body and soul. Well, people who believe, as a matter of fact, that she died, physically died, say, yeah, when the course of her earthly life was finished, she died. But people who hold the alternative that she merely went to sleep and then was taken up into the glory of heaven can also be satisfied by Pius XII's formulation.
And there are people who also describe death as eternal sleep.
Sure, sure. And just in the, an important theological point that we see underscored in Pius XII's carefulness, the Church never pronounces on matters that are inessential and allows for a variety of theological explanations as long as that doesn't threaten a truth. And so no truth is sacrificed by holding either theological position. Now, this site, this Church of the Dormition, is one of three or four places that claim that that's where Our Lady died. Some people say she died in Ephesus, some in Patmos. But at any rate, wherever it happened, wherever her passage into eternity occurred, this is one of the places that claims that. And I think a point to underscore here about this particular church is when Pius XII declared the dogma of the Assumption, promulgated the dogma of the Assumption, some people got it all backwards. They said, there's the Catholic Church making up new dogmas 19 centuries after something happened. Now they're making up a new thing that Catholics have to believe. Well, no. When a dogma is promulgated, it simply means that something that was always believed has now reached a sufficient level of theological reflection and maturity that the Church can say, this is now proposed for formal belief. Now, I mention this also because some evangelicals will say, well, there's no evidence of Scripture that Mary was assumed into heaven. Well, there is and there isn't. If you look at the 12th chapter of the book of Revelation, there are very, very strong clues that that's exactly what we're talking about, is her assumption. But more to the point, Pius didn't define in 1950 something brand new. This Church of the Dormition goes back to the 4th century. Its existence, its physical existence, points to the Church's perpetual belief in Mary's bodily assumption. And so this is what is commemorated by that physical site. Now, what does the dogma of the Assumption teach us? It teaches us, first of all, the goodness and the importance of the human body. Right now, there are two people in heaven, body and soul, our Lord, the God-man, and Our Lady, his mother and the mother of the Church. In their persons, we have the new Adam and the new Eve, body and soul, which tell us this is the fulfillment of the entire human race. All of humanity, all of saved humanity, is in some sense already in heaven by virtue of the presence of Jesus and Mary. Secondly, Mary, as the first member of the Church, as the mother of the Church, is there precisely as the Church in glory. She embodies the Church in herself. And she, as a good mother, stands at the finish line, beckoning her children to come. And she's there to welcome us to the glory of her son's kingdom. She's also there in a very important way as a symbol of redeemed womanhood. She's the new Eve. Everything that was botched up in the first Eve was repaired in the second Eve. And Mary is a model of true feminism, Christian feminism, what a woman is called to be by virtue of her dignity as a daughter of God. And so all of this coalesces in this mystery of the Assumption. At the Second Vatican Council, there was a big discussion as to whether or not there ought to be a special document on the Blessed Virgin. And those that one would consider to be more traditional or conservative argued that there ought to be, and there needed to be, because we need to highlight the place of the Blessed Mother in the life of the Church. Other people said, no, 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 for this reason or that reason, we're not going to move in that direction, but let's include her in the document on the Church. And so the eighth chapter, the last chapter of Lumen Gentium, as a matter of fact, is a sustained theological and spiritual reflection on the place of Mary in the economy of salvation. And what does that do? It inserts her into the very heart of the Church. And as a result of that document, Paul VI declared Mary to be Mother of the Church. And in her, the poet Wordsworth says, is Mary is our tainted nature's solitary boast. Everything that could ever be good in a human person is in her. Cardinal Newman refers to her as the daughter of Eve unfallen. We tend to think of original sin as something, you know, a black mark or a this or that. No, sin is an absence. And what's interesting to reflect on, Adam and Eve were created without sin. And so when Newman says that Mary is the daughter of Eve unfallen, by her immaculate conception, God's intervention at the very moment of her creation, her conception, he has preserved her, and he has made her very much what Eve herself was. Sometimes people say, well, if Mary was conceived without sin, no wonder she didn't sin, and she couldn't sin. No, no, she could sin. She could have sinned. Eve was conceived, was born without, was created without sin, but she sinned. Adam was created without sin, and he sinned. No, it's a question that her entire orientation from the moment of her conception was a response to the grace that was given to her. And therefore, she stands again at the finish line as a model, but also as an intercessor, as a mother, bidding us to follow her example and giving us confidence that her intercession, as a matter of fact, will bring us safely home.
Father Peter Stravinskas is a noted Catholic scholar and author and editor of The Catholic Response. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
Been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.